a tremendous pleasure and privilege for the community once again that the Schaeffers graced us with this memorial series as a zchus for the memory of their dear son, Olav HaShalom, Avram Nasan Zechron Levracha, Ben Daniel Nachum Ben Yamin. The Debrei Torah and the inspiration should be a tremendous plus for his neshama. It's a rare feeling I have when I hear the name of Rav Zev Lev Shlita, because I'm someone who does not remember much content from the shurim and the shmuzim that I've heard over the years. Sometimes the jokes and the stories, but I could tell you that there's a shir that Rav Lev gave when I was back a bacher in Yeshivat Sha'alvim, and that was about three decades ago. And Rav Zev's words, Rav Zev Lev's words are still ringing in my ears, inspiring me. The tshuva drasha that he gave then, it's one that I love telling over to others, and I'm sure that tonight's will be no different. But there's an even rarer opportunity that I have. People who know me from the community will certainly attest to the fact that I'm quite a shy individual. But this is a chance that I have to actually go over to someone. And I've never had the guts to just go over to Rav Lev and tell him, Rav Lev, you're one of the most primary inspirations in my life on a personal level. So today, with the excuse of this introduction, let me tell you, aside from that lecture, so when my wife and I were contemplating Aliyah, we took out the book to Dwell in a Palace, and we read the introduction together. And we were so moved by that introduction that it led to a summer spent in Ramat Beit Shemesh to look into the pragmatics of making Aliyah. And on that summer, we gave a call to Rav Lev, who's also one of the rabbeim from Mechlala of my wife. And he gave us chizuk. And the combination of his written words and his personal conversational words were among those items that tipped the balance in the positive direction for our own Aliyah. And I used to think that we were alone in that. But I've heard afterwards of countless people who said, sure, you know why I made Aliyah? You know why I make decision X, Y, Z? Sure, it was Rav Lev Shlita, whether it was a shir, whether it was a written piece, whether it was a personal conversation. Go ask the hundreds of community members in Miami or in Moshav Matatyahu or in the seminaries and yeshivas around the world, and I'm sure you'll get the same answer from all of them. It's with tremendous honor that the community has to welcome Rav Lev. We look forward to his wisdom.
Thank you for that overly generous introduction. After an introduction like that, I think it would be better if I kept quiet. Okay, I will tell you that on the one hand, I am extremely flattered that you invited me, Schaeffer invited me for a second time to give this Yahrzeit shiur, but I'm a little intimidated by it. The story goes of a chazan who gave a performance, and after he finished his last number, they asked him for an encore. So he sang it again. He finished a second time, they asked for another encore, sang it a third time. This went on over and over until after seven times, he said, I'm really flattered that you keep asking me to sing the same song, but how many times? Somebody from the back yelled out, said, you do it right. So I hope this year I'll do it right. You won't have to invite me again. As was said, the Divrei Torah to be Le'ilui Nishmas Avraham Nachshon, Ben Daniel Nachum Binyamin Le'ilui Nishmas. We are in the midst of Chodesh Elul. Elul is a preparation for Yamin Noraim. And in order to prepare properly, you have to understand what Elul is all about and how to use it properly. Basically, Elul has three aspects to it. The first aspect is it's a siyum of the year. And as we'll see, a siyum is a very important. Hakol holich achar hagmar, Chazal say. Everything goes on how you finish, or as the secular world says, all's well that ends well. That is the first aspect of Elul. Siyum hashon. The second aspect is that it is the 30-day preparation before every yontif. 30 days before the yontif, we begin preparing for that yontif. The yontif of Rosh Hashanah is 30 days from the beginning of Elul. So Elul is a preparation for Rosh Hashanah, which is Reishis Hashanah, a new beginning. So Elul has in it the concept of ending and the concept of preparing for beginning. That's also important, we'll see. And lastly, Elul begins a 40-day process that culminates on Yom Kippur, corresponding to the last 40 days that Moshe Rabbeinu was on Har Sinai, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu forgave Klal Yisrael for the Chet HaEgel and eventually gave them the second Luchos. So it's the beginning of a 40-day process that culminates in Yom Kippur. Those are the three aspects of Elul. Before I go on, I want to bring you greetings from my son. That's my yichus over here, Yossi. He came in for a wedding last night of his niece, who happens also to be my granddaughter. And he's leaving tonight. Somehow the Rav Moshe gave him the schus of not having to be here. So I'm sure that he would want me to send his regards. I know when he was here, he was an active member of this Kehiva. In any case, so I want to discuss in somewhat detail these three aspects of Elul. Let's start with the first one. Elul is the siyum of the year. A siyum is a very important thing. Shlomo HaMelech says in Koheles, Tov achris davar mereshisa. How you end something is more important than how you begin. Chazal say, Hakol holeich achar hagmar, everything goes on how you finish. In addition to that, we know that when you finish a Maseches in Gemara or a Sefer in Tanakh, you make a siyum. We learn that from the fact that Shlomo HaMelech made a tremendous yontif when he finished building the first Beis HaMikdash. And from there we learn Shaosim Simcha Ligmara Shel Torah. When you finish a unit in Torah, you make a tremendous simcha. So finishing a siyum is a tremendous, tremendous event. There's only one problem. In opposition to all of that, the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Lo Alecho Hamalacha Ligmara. You don't have to finish anything in Torah. So it's a big deal about finishing. But we celebrate finishing if you don't have to finish anything. And secondly, at a siyum, we say something that the way the Chafetz Chaim explains it makes a siyum irrelevant. We say at a siyum, Modi manachmu lefonecho Hashem elokeinu velokei avoseinu shesamta chalkeinu beyoshvei beitzamedrish velosamta chalkeinu beyoshvei kronos. Thank the Rabbanu Shalom for giving our portion amongst those that seek to learn Torah and not those that waste away their lives. We get up and they get up. Ono mashkinim with divrei Torah, they mashkinim with dvarim b'tehillim. Ono anelim, they anelim. We work and they work. We toil and they toil. Ono anelim with mekablim shchar. We toil and we get rewarded for it. They anelim, they ain't a mekablim shchar. And they toil and they get no reward for it. Says the Chafetz Chaim, it's not true. Nobody works in this world for nothing. People get rewarded, they get paid. They get satisfaction. Nobody does something for nothing. What it should have said is, we toil and we get eternal reward. The Hemanelim and they get temporal reward. But Hemanelim, the Enum, the Kablim, stop. Says the Chafetz Chaim, what it means is the following. If you give wood, lumber, to a carpenter, and you tell him, I want you to make me a table. I'll pick it up in a month and I'll pay you. A month later, you come to pick up the table and the wood is sitting there just as you left. The carpenter gives you a bill for $500. She said, what's the bill for? He said, I put a lot of work into your wood. You see, every day I carried it up 10 flights of stairs and slipped it down 10 flights of stairs. And I practice putting in nails and taking them out and closing up the holes. So I want you to pay me $500 for the work I put into your wood. You wouldn't pay him a penny. Because in the secular world, you pay for results. If you make a table, you'll pay him commensurate to how much work he put in creating that table. But if he doesn't make a table, you won't pay him for his labor. But in the Torah world, it's not like that, says the Chafetz Chaim. In the Torah world, we get rewarded for the effort. You can come here and sit here for the next hour and understand nothing that I say, walk out more confused than you did when you came in here, and you will get rewarded for 1 hour of suffering through Torah, even if you accomplish nothing. So we get rewarded, we work and toil and get rewarded. They work and toil and get no reward for the work and the toil. They only get reward if they produce results. That's the case. So when we celebrate finishing anything, we don't need to finish, you just have to put in the effort. So what is the big simcha of a seal? If you think about it, also it doesn't make sense. You learned a mesechta in Gemara for a year. Every day you learned 45 minutes, an hour, and broke your head over it. And the last line of Gemara, you make a big party. Makes sense? For one line, you make a big party, and for all the other things, you don't make any party. So, therefore, it seems to me that the simcha of a siyum is not finishing. Something else completely. It's a side benefit. The Gemara in Bava Basra says that when you write a shtar for a field, you sell a field and you document it. So in the document, you have to be Messiah Mesrinohi, which means you have to identify and outline the borders of the field. So you know which field you sold. It's bordered with a gas station on the north and with a fence on the south and so on and so on. The word Messiah, you see, does not necessarily mean to finish. The word Messiah can mean to outline and to identify. You ever make one of these 500-piece jigsaw puzzles? Usually, when you buy the puzzle, in the box on the cover is a picture of what the puzzle is going to be. What if you went to a yard sale and they sold you 500 pieces and they promised you every piece is there, but they lost the box and they have no idea what the picture is. So you start putting it together, matching the colors. This looks like sky, this looks like ground. You have no idea what it is. As you progress, you get a bit of a good idea. Maybe this is the ground, these are trees, this is the sky. When will you be able to identify every single piece of that puzzle, what it means when you put the last piece into the puzzle? When you put the last piece and you see the whole picture, then you're able to see the meaning of every piece in light of the whole. Until you see something it's in entirety, you don't get a really actual picture, right, an understanding of what it's all about. It's only when you see it in its totality, you see the whole picture, then you can understand each and every part. If you start a Gemara Ksuvos, which I imagine many of you are in the middle of learning. So when you start with Ksuvos and this doesn't make too much sense and this you don't understand or whatever, when you finish the whole Masechta and you've seen the entire gamut of what Ksuvos is, then you get a better understanding of everything you learn because now you put in the final piece. So when you make that seal, you're not celebrating one line, but you're celebrating that one line now makes you relearn in 1 second everything you learn because you see it now in the light of the totality. So you're celebrating the totality of the learning almost a second time by going and putting that final piece in. The Vilna Gaon points out something about the word siyum that he uses for some other purpose, but I'm going to use it for my purpose, what he says. Every letter in the Aleph Beis has a nigla and a nister. The nigla is the letter you see. Aleph is an Aleph. But then there's the hidden part of the Aleph. You spell it Aleph Lamed Fe. So the Aleph is the open part, and the Lamed Fe is the hidden part. Beis, you spell Beis Yud Tav. The Beis is what you see, and the Yud and the Tav are the hidden part. He said the word Siyum is very interesting because if you take the Samach that you see is in numerical value 60. What's the hidden part? Mem Chav. Mem is 40, Chav is 20, 60. So the nigla, the part you see, and the nister, the part that's hidden, are exactly the same. Yud, spelled Yud, Vav, Dalet. The Yud is 10, Vav is 6, Dalet is 4, 6 and 4 is 10. So what you see, the Yud, is the same as what you don't see, the Vav and the Dalet. Vav is Vav, Vav. The part you see is Vav, and the part you don't see is Vav. And Mem is Mem, Mem, same thing. Says the Vilna Gaon, by a siyum, the nigla and the nister are the same. I usually use this to praise the women who send their husbands to learn, and they're the nister part of the siyum, and the men are the nigla part. But I think there's another idea. When you finish that last line and you make the siyum, the nigla is one line, but the nister is relearning everything because now you see it in light of the whole, and not as a piecemeal and a partial rendering of the subject. With this, you can understand the following. The Gemara says, "Ein ha-mitzvah nikra ela al-shem gomro." Somebody starts a mitzvah and he doesn't finish it. And someone else comes along and finishes that mitzvah. So the mitzvah is given credit to the one who finished. Where did we learn that from? From Moshe Rabbeinu in Klal Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu was Moser Nefesh. When everybody else was going to get gold and silver in Mitzrayim, Moshe Rabbeinu went to get the bones of Yosef, and he carried them with him and supervised them for 40 years in the desert. He wasn't able to finish the mitzvah and take the bones and bury them in Shechem, because he didn't get into Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't his choosing. Klal Yisrael finished off the mitzvah. And what does the Navi say? Yes, Atzmos Yosef, Asher Helu B'nei Yisrael, in Mitzrayim, Kovru B'Shem. Gives credit to Klal Yisrael. So it doesn't make sense, really.
I mean, why should the credit go to the one who finished it? Moshe Rabbeinu didn't abandon the mitzvah. It was beyond his control. Why should Klal Yisrael get the credit for the mitzvah that Moshe Rabbeinu spent most of the time doing with tremendous research and effort? But it doesn't say that Klal Yisrael got the reward and Moshe Rabbeinu didn't. Of course, Moshe Rabbeinu got the lion's share of reward for that mitzvah. But on whose name is it called? In order for a mitzvah to be called on your name, so today you have to spend money. Right? If you spend enough money, they put a plaque up, and the mitzvah is called on your name. But in the time of Chazal, in the time of the Torah, you didn't get your name on a mitzvah by spending money. You got your name on a mitzvah by being Moser Nefesh, by attaching yourself and connecting yourself to that mitzvah. The Aaron wasn't called on the name of his shalom, so Moser Nefesh not show that Rashi says. He bonded with that mitzvah. And if you bond with the mitzvah, it's called on your name. Like we said, you can't really appreciate a mitzvah until you see it in its totality. But if you see it piecemeal, right, you can get tremendous reward for it, but you can't bond with it because you don't really see the entire picture. Moshe Rabbeinu only saw a portion of the mitzvah. He didn't see the end. Klal Yisrael saw the portion they did. They also saw the portion that Moshe did. They were able to see the entire mitzvah. They were able to bond with it. So it's called on their name. That's what it means. In any case, so we see that finishing is important, not because you finished, but because at that point you're able to see the total picture of what you learned, what you were involved in, and in that way you see the real significance of it and not piecemeal. With that, we can understand the following chazal. The Svarim bring down that a person who does tshuva the last day of the year is like he did tshuva the whole year. Now, if that means that if you do tshuva the last day of the year, it counts for the whole year, what's a big deal? Whenever you do tshuva, it helps retroactively from the time you did the sin. So it's not something special about the last day of the year. Whenever you do tshuva, it helps retroactively. So what's so special about the last day of the year? Based on what we said, what the importance of finishing is, that you see the whole picture, can explain it in the following way. Imagine somebody who never had any business experience, and he went into business, he opened a business, and in order to open the business, he had to put down money to rent a place, put down perhaps a deposit on the electricity, the gas, he had to buy stock. He looks in his ledger and he says, this is a losing business. I didn't even open my doors yet, and I'm thousands of dollars in debt. He opens his doors, and the first day, people buy out his entire stock for a tremendous profit. So the first day in his business, he's already in the black, thousands of dollars. He says, wow, this is a great business. If this lasts, right, for the next few weeks, I'll be a millionaire. I'll be able to close the business. Then he realizes he has no more stock. So he has to buy new stock. So part of his profits already go to buy new stock. And then comes in the bill for the rent and the gas and the electric. And he doesn't have all of that profit, but something he has. The next month, he has a terrible loss, and the business is a loss. He thinks this is a terrible business. I'm going to close the business. The next month, again, he has tremendous profits. And this is the way it goes the whole year. Some months, it seems to be a profitable business. Some months, it seems to be a losing business. Some months, he breaks even. How do you know if that business is profitable or not? You wait till the end of the year, and you take inventory. And you add up all your profits, subtract all of your losses, take into consideration all of your stock, and then bottom line is red, black or red, then you know if it's a good business or not. Similarly, people sometimes get up in the morning on the right side of the bed, and they get St. Mother Annie with great kavana and wash their hands and get dressed and run to shul. Where a woman gets up and she starts to get her children ready for school and makes her husband get out of bed so he goes to daven. And they both feel like big tzaddikim and tzikanios. They what's it called? The ani comes to the door or on the way to shul. The man passes an ani, gives him money, makes him feel good, sits and learns. Woman takes care of her home. By the end of the day, they consider themselves tzaddikim gemurim. Next day, they get up on the wrong side of the bed. They don't say molta ani with any kavana. They don't wash properly, right? They oversleep and don't get to shul. They kick the army on the way to shul. By the time they go to sleep, they feel like they're the biggest rishayim in the world. And this goes on the whole year. Sometimes you feel like a tzaddik at the end of the day. Sometimes you feel like a rasha. Sometimes you feel like a benami. How do you know what you really are? You wait till the end of the year and you look at all the days of the year. Were the up days the rule and the down days the exception to the rule, then I'm doing okay. The opposite, then I'm not doing so good. You take inventory of yourself. But you can't know that until you see the whole year, until you see the whole picture of yourself for a whole year. So therefore, a person that's tshuva the last day of the year is not tshuva for one thing. It's tshuva for an entire year. It's not that it helps for the year. It always helps retroactively. But it's not tshuva from one day. It's tshuva that covers the entire year. That's what it means. Person does tshuva the last day of the year, but he did tshuva the entire year. And therefore, that's what Shlomo HaMelech said. Tov achris tovah mereishisah. The end of something is greater than the beginning, because in the end you get a good total picture, and in the beginning, until the end, you only see a fragment, and you really can't see how things really are, whether it's in learning, whether it's in living, or whatever. So that is the first aspect of Elul. It's the siyum of the year. Gives you a chance to make inventory, to look back over the past year, to see what positive things you want to bring into the coming year, what negative things you want to leave as lost baggage in the past year, and what things need to be improved, what things have to be discarded. So it's a time of preparation by finishing off the year properly. So that is the first aspect of Elul. It's the end of the year. And I think that corresponds. Oh, thank you, sir. You brought it already. Don't bring any more, it's not a shape. I think that corresponds to the hint of Elul in Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li, which only does not only mean my relationship with Hashem, but Ani L'Dodi, first I have to know who I am, and then I can know who the Rabbanu Shel Olam is, and then I can know what our relationship is. So Elul gives me a chance to get to know myself by taking inventory, getting a chance to see how the Rabbanu Shel Olam interacted with me over a year. And then when I know who I am and who he is, then I can use Elul in the most positive way. Second aspect of Elul. It's a 30-day preparation for the beginning of a new year. And we know that beginnings first are very important. All firsts are kodesh lashem, firstborn, first shearing of the wool, reishis hagetz, Truma is called Reishis, Chal is Reishis Arusatechem, like the Choros, firstborn of the animals and of people, right? To be in Aben, first are all important. Now I have no problem understanding that the first is the best. So you give the best to the Rabbanu Shalom. I'm a firstborn. My brothers, Aleihem Mashallah, may not have agreed with that. And the truth is that sometimes that's the case. The first is not necessarily the best. It was in my case, but it doesn't necessarily have to happen. Right? The first could be not the best. Second, third. So why does the Rabbanim say, dedicate the first to me? Why doesn't he say, look, take a few samples, and whichever is the best from all of them, bring that to me? Why the first? So one idea is that the first is the yesod and shoresh. It's the foundation and root of everything that comes after this. And just like in a building, if you have a hairline crack in the foundation, it endangers the entire building. On the other hand, that same hairline crack on the third floor is not going to endanger anything. Similarly, if you have a pigam, you have some kind of blemish in the root of a plant, it's going to come out in the plant 1,000 times. That same blemish on the leaf isn't going to make any difference. So when you're talking about creating the foundation and root for everything that comes afterwards, it has to be as perfect as possible. So we dedicate all the firsts to Hashem because they serve as the root and foundation of everything that's going to come after that. Two examples, one on the positive side, one on the negative side. Start with the negative so we can end with the positive. The Gemara, our Gemara in Kiddushin says, what happened to Elisha ben Avuya that turned him into Achim? Why did he go off the derech? Elisha ben Avuya, Tana. So because one of the reasons the Gemara says, because he saw something tragic that he couldn't accept. He saw a man tell his son to climb a ladder and bring him some eggs from a bird's nest. The son followed his father's desire, fulfilled the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av, went up, sent the mother bird away, and took the eggs of Mekayim the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein. On the way down, he fell off the ladder and was killed. Elisha ben Avuya said, on these two mitzvahs specifically, Kibbutz Av V'Ein and Shiluach HaKein, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises, Varachta Yomim, Arichas Yomim. Where's the Arichas Yomim with this poor little youngster who in the midst of fulfilling both of these mitzvahs fell off the ladder and died? Less deep, less time. Came a kofi. Can't be. The Yerushalmi says a different shot. Yerushalmi in Chagiga says that Elisha ben Avuya's problem started way before that, the day of his bris. Elisha ben Avuya, his father, was one of the richest men in Yerushalayim. And he invited to the bris all the chachmei Yerushalayim, all the gedolim of Yerushalayim, and all the rich people of Yerushalayim. And he made a lavish party for the bris. So the rich people started eating and drinking and enjoying the bris. The gedolim were sitting together, said, Inu b'ditu, they're having their simcha, let us have our simcha. So they started learning. And they went from Chumash to Nach, and Nach to Mishnah, and Mishnah to Kabbalah. They mamish were on the level of Matan Torah, and therefore a fire came out in Hashemayim and surrounded them. Avuya went over to him and says, what are you trying to do? Burn down my house? What's this fire in the middle of the house? He said, no, don't worry. It's a spiritual fire. We were learning with such a brand that we brought down the fire of Sinai here into this room. Avuya said, wow, if that's the power of people who learn Torah, I want my kids to learn Torah. I want him to be able to bring fire in Hashemayim. And since the reason for learning Torah is not to bring fire in the Neshamayim, it's to fulfill the Ratzon HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Elisha ben Avuya's entire foundation was crooked, and he never changed it. And therefore, he went off the derech. And there's no contradiction between the two Gemaras. Because Elisha ben Avuya did not have to come to the conclusion that less din, less dying, there's no justice in this world, when he saw that youngster fall off the ladder. Because his nephew also saw that, the Gemara says. And he came to a different conclusion. When the Torah promises long life, it doesn't mean in this physical world. It means long life, eternal life. Because reward for mitzvahs is not in this world. So why didn't Elisha ben Avuya come to that conclusion? Because since his foundation was, you learn and observe the Torah to bring fire from the heaven. So he's looking for some benefit here, some effect. So he saw crookedly what his nephew was able to see in the right light. So therefore, if you don't have the right foundation and the right root, if it's blemished and you don't change it, you build on that, you're building on a blemished root that will come out into the plant 1,000 times, and you're building on a cracked foundation that eventually will topple the building. The opposite's also true. The Gemara says that Reb Chiya said that if the Torah is ever forgotten, I have a program how to bring the Torah back. Here's his program. I will plant flax, linen. When it grows, I'll harvest it, and I'll make it into rope. And the rope I will make into nets. And with the nets, I'll capture deer. And the deer I will slaughter and give the flesh to poor people. And the hides I will make into cloth, into parchment. And on the parchment I will write Chamisha Chumshe Torah. And I'll go from city to city and choose 5 youngsters and teach each one a different Chumash. And 6 youngsters and teach each one a different Seder Mishnah. And then I'll say, I'm leaving. Each of you teach the others what I taught you. And that way, the Torah will be reclaimed. So the Svarim asks, including the Marshal, the Chora understand that if it's the time the Torah has been forgotten, you can't walk into a Svarim store and buy a Chumash or buy a Mishnah. So they had to write them themselves. But don't they have Army Navy stores where they sell nets, where they sell what's it called, a cloth? Right? That's also not being sold. Why did Reb Chiya have to go and plant the linen, make the rope, make the nets, capture the deer, go into a store and buy cloth? The answer they say is, since the Torah was forgotten, Reb Chiya is creating the root and the foundation of all Torah from that time on. And that Torah has to be so pure that even the nets with which you capture the deer to write the Torah on its hide has to be 100% the same Shemai. So that is the idea that the first are the root and the foundation for everything that comes afterwards, and therefore has to be as perfect as possible. So we dedicate all first to the Rabbana Shalom, in hope that that which will follow, whatever it may be, will be built on that firm foundation and come from that perfect root. With that, we can understand the following halach. Says in Shulchan Aruch that even someone who eats pas pauter a whole year, okay, pas pauter is bread, cake, that's baked by a non-Jew, but a commercial non-Jew. If your neighbor is not Jewish, but he wants to bake you a birthday cake. So he says, look, you give me all the ingredients. You give me, what's it called, all the kelim. Come to my house and you be the mashgiach and I'll bake you the cake. You're not going to eat that cake. Unless the Jew either lit the fire or was involved in the actual baking process. But if you know 100% it's kosher, but it's baked by a non-Jew, that's pas akum and sauce. However, if your neighbor is a baker, commercial baker, and he has hashgacha, right? And even if the Jew has no connection to the baking process, it's kosher. That's called pas powder. However, it's not the chachil. It's not mahadron, right? Those who came from America, and I imagine most of you did, if you understand what I'm saying, and if you don't, what in the world are you sitting here for? Came from America, if you remember Drake's cakes. So they're a pas powder, okay? They have a big OU on them, and they're kosher. There's a mashgiach there, but the mashgiach does not have any connection to the baking process. It's not pas Yisrael. So the halacha is that if you can't find a similar baked product of the same quality or price, then you're allowed to eat the pas powder. Except it says in the Shulchan Aruch that someone who eats pas powder a whole year during Aseret Yemei from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, he should not eat pas powder. If you think about it, that doesn't make too much sense. What are we trying to do? Impress the Rabbanu Shel Olam and fool him, right? In other words, the whole year, I'm not such a big son. I eat pas powder. But I'm being judged now from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur. I want God to think I'm a big son. So I stopped eating pas powder, and I said, Rabbanu Shel Olam, you better give me a good thing because I don't eat pas powder. Now, I would understand if you're taking a chance, and maybe you'll continue that, right? And you're starting a new year, maybe to be a little bit more formal. Okay, that makes sense, but that's not what it's talking about. It's talking about a person who does not intend to stop eating pas powder the minute Yom Kippur is over. He has an order in for Drake's cakes to break his fast. But from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, I don't eat pas powder. So what is he doing? Fooling the Rabbanu Shel Olam? And then Ni'il after Ni'il on Yom Kippur, he goes home and he says, I fooled you, God. I do eat pas powder, but the mishpat's over. Doesn't make sense, but it does make sense. Because Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur is Reishis Hashanah. It's the beginning, not just the beginning, it's the foundation and root of the coming year. And just like by the foundation and root, you want it to be as perfect as possible. Someone's building a building, and he has 10 sacks of grade A cement and 90 sacks of grade B cement. And you ask him, my height. And he says, well, you see, grade A cement costs double what grade B cement costs. I can't afford to put grade A cement in the whole building. But I bought grade A cement to put into the foundation, because the foundation is much more important than the rest of the building, because the whole building rests on the foundation. Would you consider that person a hypocrite? No, it makes a lot of sense. Person says, look, I can't hold myself back from eating Drake's cakes the whole year. But I'm setting the foundation for my new year. I want it to be as perfect as possible. So for these 10 days, I'm going to use grade A cement because I'm setting the foundation and the root for the coming year. That's the idea of all the homeless. People daven better during Aseret Yemei. They give more tzedakah. They're not trying to fool the Rabbanu Shel Olam. What they're trying to do is create a foundation and a root which is as perfect as possible, even if they can't keep up that for the rest of the year. So it does make sense. Another idea of why firsts are very important, because the first is something new, and it's exciting, and it's fresh, and something you've done over and over again, you lose your enthusiasm. Here you're more enthusiastic about something new. So first things you dedicate to the Rabbanu Shel Olam because they are accompanied by a lot of emotion and a lot of enthusiasm. Perhaps here it's a good marshal for a woman, a new dress, that's something exciting. Even if you have 20 dresses in your closet, but they're all, they're not as exciting as that new dress. I don't know that from experience, but I imagine now I see my wife reacts to new things, which she doesn't get too often for me. So she obviously considers that something special. In any case, so it's another idea of, and Torah and mitzvahs have to always be fresh and with enthusiasm, because a mitzvah that you do besimcha and with enthusiasm is different than a mitzvah you just do lackadaisically. The Medrash says, and the pasuk, the yitku l'arov bekerav ha'oretz, we're compared to fish. The Medrash says, in what way are Klal Yisrael supposed to be like fish? The Medrash says the following, that if you look at fish when it rains, they come to the top of the pond and they gulp down the raindrops. Now, that doesn't make too much sense. Fish are inundated with water, outside, inside, through their gills. Like, what in the world are fish gulping down the raindrops? There's not enough water. But the Rav Moshe put into the nature of a fish that it never gets tired of water, and every drop of water it experiences is like it never tasted water in its life. Because a fish would get tired of water and they take a vacation in the desert, they wouldn't come back from vacation. So the Rav Moshe gave the fish that nature, they never tire of water. The Medrash says there's something else like that. Imagine if you had to eat your favorite food, whatever your favorite food is, you had to eat it breakfast, lunch, and supper every single day, day in and day out. How long do you think it would take until you get disgusted and wouldn't want to look at that food again? So what about a baby? Baby drinks milk in the morning, afternoon, night, for days, for weeks. Why doesn't the baby say, look, if you can't give me something else, I'm going on a hunger strike. Right? No more milk, enough already. If the baby would say that, there wouldn't be any more baby. So the Rav Moshe made a nest that every drop of milk that a baby drinks is a new taste, like he never drank milk in his life. Same thing with Torah. Ki hein chayenu va'orech yomenu. If we get tired of the Torah and mitzvahs, we couldn't live. So the Rav Moshe gave us the power to constantly feel new tastes in Torah, even if you heard it before. It's a new taste, and it's if you want to take advantage of it. By the baby and the fish, it's automatic. By Torah, it has said you have a choice. You have to choose to want to make that new taste. But the revolution gave us the power, if we want to use our free choice to access that, we have the power to do it. So therefore, first are very, very important. And Elul is a preparation for beginning a new year and getting that new taste, a new year. It's not Tavshin Pei Beis anymore. It's Tavshin Pei Gimel. It's a new year. There's another mila in the beginning, in Horatius. And that is that when a person starts something, he can commit himself for the future. And committing oneself, even if you haven't done anything, is a very, very positive thing. How do I know that? The Medrash says. The Medrash says, Moshe Rabbeinu commanded Klal Yisrael about the coming Pesach holiday, when they would be redeemed from Egypt on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. He told them what's going to happen, that on the 10th day they have to take a set, and they have to shecht it on the 14th, and they have to eat it on the 15th. All the halachas of Korban Pesach. And Pesach. Right immediately after that, Moshe finished the shiur. It says, "Vayelchu vayasu b'nei Yisrael." They went and they did it. It says the members didn't do anything for 10 days. I mean, they went and they did it. They didn't do anything. It was 10 days till they did the first thing to take the set. Elokim and shekiva aleihem lasso. Since they committed themselves to do it, it's as if they did it already. Commitment is something very important. The Rabbeinu Yonah says in Pirkei Avos, Kol she chachmaso meruva mimaisav. So the person who's chachma, he knows more than he does, so his maisim will not remain. But somebody should maisav meruva mechachmaso, he has more maisim than he knows, then his chachma will remain. So Rabbeinu Yonah asks, how can you do more than you know? You can do what you know. How can you do more than you know? says you can do more than you know if you accept and commit yourself. That whatever you learn, you'll do, then from the commitment on, it's as if you did it. You don't know it yet, but it's as if you did it because you committed yourself to it. So commitment is a very, very important thing. And when you begin something, that's the time that you can commit yourself for the future, right? New Year's resolutions on Rosh Hashanah are very important. It's a commitment. That's also considered like you did it already if you're sincere in the commitment. There's a special bracha for somebody who commits themselves to the Torah, says Rabbi Yonah. Baruch Hashem Yakin as Divrei HaTorah Hazot. It's a special bracha for someone who accepts upon himself and commits himself to keep the whole Torah, even if he hasn't done anything yet. So that is a second aspect of Rosh Hashanah, and that is a second aspect of Elul, preparing oneself to begin a new year. Elul is the siyum of the year, and it's also the preparation for a beginning. And like we said, ending and beginning are both important, and they're both in that same pasuk. There's two ways of learning that pasuk: Tov Achris Dover Mereshisa. The first way is what we said before. Tov Achris Dover. The end of something is better than the beginning. There's another way of learning it. Tov Achris Dover. You know when the end will be good? Mereshisa, if the beginning is good. If you set the foundation and the root and the beginning was good, the end will be good too. Because you're building on a good, solid foundation and healthy root. But if the beginning wasn't so good and you're building on a blemished root and blemished cracked foundation, the end is not going to be good either. So both of those things represented by Rosh Hashanah, I think maybe a little bit paraphrasing what the Sakhma Rebbe said. It says in the pasuk, Asher Einei Hashem Elokecha Bo Mereishis Hashanah Bad Achris Shanah. Beginning it says Hashanah, and then it says Shanah. So Sakhma Rebbe said that when a person starts a new year, he thinks this is going to be Hashanah. This year is going to be really special. At the end of the year, he knows it was Shanah. It was just a plain year. It wasn't so special. But maybe it's another pshat. And that is, if you start the year properly and you make it Hashanah and you commit yourself and you make the root and the foundation as perfect as possible, that's the way you start a year. At the end of the year, you realize that maybe not everything was the way it should be. Now you take inventory and you finish off the year by taking inventory, and that is how you end the year. So that's Elul. Elul prepares you for beginning Hashanah. At the same time, it's a time of Shanah. You reach the end of the year and you realize that it's not so perfect. Now you take inventory to see what you want to take into the coming year and what you want to leave in the past. So those are the first two aspects of Elul. It is the siyum of the year and the preparation for a new beginning of a new year. The third aspect is the beginning of a 40-day process that culminates in Yom Kippur. What is this idea of a 40-day process? The number 40 is very significant. We find it in many places. 40 days of the Mabul, 40 days of the Matan Torah, 40 years in the Midbar. The number 40 signifies the following, Chazal said. In nature, it takes 40 days for an embryo to form within the mother's womb. That's called Argoyim Yom Kineged Yetziras Havlad. Now, that doesn't mean that a baby is ready to be born after 40 days. Okay? Ask any woman, she'll tell you that after 40 days, she doesn't, that's not the end of her pregnancy. So, what is this Yetziras Havlad? So, many years ago, I thought maybe it means the following. At 40 days, the major systems of the body are formed. It's a little human being. And after that, it's growth. they grow, but the formation is in those first 40 days. And then I found something that corroborated that idea. There was an organization in America, I don't know if it still exists, called the March of Dimes. March of Dimes dealt with children with birth defects. And I once saw a pamphlet that they sent out, and they said the following. They said a woman who is pregnant should be very, very careful the first 6 weeks of pregnancy, not to drink alcohol, not to smoke, not to take drugs that are not prescribed by a doctor, specifically okay for pregnant women, because in those 6 weeks, that's when the embryo is forming, the major systems of the body are formed, and while they're forming, things could go wrong and there could be birth defects. But after 6 weeks, the basic systems of the body are formed, and therefore it's just a matter of growth. Once they're formed, not too much can affect them. 6 weeks is 42 days. So the scientists were only off for 2 days, right? Chazal said it's 40 days exactly. They rounded it off to 6 weeks, 42 days. What's so terrible for a woman who doesn't smoke for another 2 days? So that's the formation, the Yetziras HaVlad. And since in nature, a new formation is represented by 40 days, the number 40 became in nature a symbol of a new formation. Whatever you want to create a new formation, it's connected to the number 40. The Mabul destroyed an old world and began a new formation of a new world, 40 days and 40 nights. Torah, before the Torah, the world was one way. Torah created a new world, 40 days and 40 nights. The desert, 40 years, an old generation had to die out and a new generation had to be formed, 40 years. A mikveh has 40 saw. Person goes in, Tomei, and comes out a new Bria, a new creation, a new Yetzirah. After coming to the mikveh has 40 saw. So the number 40 is representative of a new formation. When a person does tshuva, it's a new formation. About tshuva is like a new person. You're not the same person as you were before. Therefore, you're not allowed to tell about tshuva. Remember what you used to do before you did tshuva? Because before you did tshuva, he's a different person. Now he's committed to ketinik shenola. It's like a new person. So that process of tshuva, right, takes 40 days. What is the part of Elul? So tshuva has basically three or four parts to it. The first part is enabling you to start doing tshuva. It's not really part of the tshuva itself. It's called hakara sacheg, recognizing you did something wrong. Because if you think you're a tzaddik and you do nothing wrong, there's nothing to tshuva about. So in order to start the process, you need to recognize that you did something wrong, hakara sacheg. Then you can start doing tshuva. Then you have harata, I regret doing something wrong. And then I can, well, before that, I stopped doing the Avera. What kind of Avera? The Shari Tshuva says, some Averas you stop immediately, and then you have regret that you did it. Some Averas you have regret, and therefore you stop. It's not the topic tonight. I'm not going to go and explain which Averas are the first way and which way the second way. Look up the Shari Tshuva, and he says it. In any case, so that's the next stage, regret and stopping to do the Avera. And then there's Kabbalah Ha'asid, that you accept upon yourself not to do it again. And then comes Vigilui, where you verbally confess all these things. I did an Avera, I regret it, and I won't do it again. And you verbally confess before the Ramamashim. Those are the stages of tshuva. Rosh Hashanah is basically Azivas HaChet. I leave the Chet in the past year and I start a new leaf, new person, right? I'm starting a new clean slate for the coming year. So that's Azivas HaChet. I left the faith. Then comes Aser Shemei Tshuva, which, I feel bad that I did the sin in the past. And finally comes Yom Kippur, where I am mekabel not to do it again. And I say, Vidui. Yom Kippur is full of Vidui, Yashamnu, Al-Chet, and so on. So what's left for Elul? Elul is 30 days to recognize that you did something wrong, that you sinned. Because if you don't have an Elul and recognize that you were Chote, there's nothing to go on beyond that. You don't need Rosh Hashanah to take a vacation. So Elul is a time to recognize that you did something wrong. Now, how do you do that? What's included in recognizing you did something wrong? First thing is you have to learn. Because somebody who knows nothing more about Shabbos, then you don't drive on Shabbos. There are people like that. Shabbos, you don't light fires and you don't drive. Okay, he has no knowledge of Lamentes Malachas of Shabbos. Shabbos, and he's the Shomer Shabbos. He never drove on Shabbos, never lit up a cigarette on Shabbos, never lit his oven on Shabbos. He's Shomer Shabbos. He doesn't know anything about Lamentes Malachas. So every Shabbos, he can be Mechal Shabbos in 39 different ways. He doesn't know. So there's nothing to do tshuva about. Because he's a Shomer Shabbos. He doesn't drive. He doesn't light fire. So first you have to learn, right? And it's not good enough just to learn what the Averas are, but to learn how serious they are. Because if you think they're not serious, then big deal. So I did something wrong. So the first stage of recognizing sin is learning about it and learning how serious it is. Learning the quantity and the quality. That's the first thing. But that's not enough. You can know all the sins. Be a big Talmid Chacham. Know every single sin and what's Chayim Malkus and what's Chayim Kores. And you can fool yourself and think that a sin is really a mitzvah and a mitzvah is really a sin. How so? The Baal Shem Tov explains the Gemara, the simple meaning of the Gemara is completely different, but the Baal Shem Tov said there's a more esoteric meaning to this Gemara. The Gemara says, Hashochei b'may mischayev. When a person shechts an animal, this is a simple meaning. When you shecht an animal on Shabbos, what malacha is? What did you do that killed Shabbos? So one Mandi Omer says, Mishum netilas neshama. You killed the animal. And killing an animal, taking away its life, is a malacha. The other Amora says, Mishum tzoveya. Aside from killing the animal, you're also guilty of dyeing for the wine, D-Y-E-I-N-G. You're coloring the neck of the animal to make it look fresh, right? And you're dyeing the neck, and that's another malacha, tzoveya. Says the Baal Shem Tov, there's an esoteric meaning to this Gemara. The Shochet is a euphemism for the Yetzer Hara, for the Malach HaMavis, for the Satan. They're all the same person. Who has Satan, who Malach HaMavis, who Yetzer Hara. And it says in the future, God is going to shecht the, what's it called, the Yetzer Hara, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Shochet, the Malach HaMavis. Why is the Yitzhara going to be killed? Why is he going to be shafted? All he did was do his job. The Rebbeinu created the Malach HaMavis, created the Yitzhara and the Satan to try to make you do an Aveira, to give you free choice. All he did was his job. Why should he be shafted? Says the Baal Shem Tov, Mishum Netilas Neshama. He's supposed to give you the choice to do an aveda. He's not supposed to be so successful that he causes you to die. That much, he does his job too good. And the second opinion is, mishum tzoveya. If the Satan would come to you and say, look, stay in bed, you're tired. If you go, what's it called, forget about davening today. Right? You're too tired to daven. So you have a choice. Should I not daven? Should I get up and inconvenience myself? You have a choice to go and daven, do a mitzvah, or to do an aveira and stay in bed. But it doesn't come to you like that. The Satan comes and says, you know, you have to go learn You have to go to work. You're very tired. If you get up and down and now, the whole day, you're not going to be learning properly. You're not going to be working properly or a condom. It's a mitzvah to stay in bed and sleep, right? So you'll be able to work properly the rest of the day. You'll be able to learn properly the rest of the day. So he colors and dyes the aveira and makes it look like a mitzvah. So even if you know every aveira in the book and how serious it is, you could fool yourself into thinking what you're doing is not an aveira, it's really a mitzvah. So that is the second thing available. Not only do you have to learn and find out what's right and what's wrong, but you have to not fool yourself and not be subjective and see things in a very distorted way. That's also not enough. Because even if you know you've done something wrong, and you know that it's wrong, but then people come up with all different kinds of excuses and justifications for what they did. I always like to say, the Rambam says that the minimal confession on Yom Kippur is three words. Avo anachnu chatanu. But we have sinned. The truth is, that's not the translation. The word aval can mean but it also can mean verily, in truth. Aval ashemim anachnu. So the word aval can mean in truth. That's really the meaning. Avol anachnu chatanu. But I was thinking that perhaps it can mean what it usually means, but it still makes sense. The whole year, we say the same words, but not in the same order. We say, anachnu chatanu aval. We sing, but, and this excuse, that excuse, this justification, that justification. By the time you finish, you didn't do any aveira, you did a mitzvah. On Yom Kippur, you have to come and say the same three words in a different order. Anachnu aval, and after all the ifs, ands, and buts, anachnu chatanu, you remain with the same. Forget about the justifications, forget about the excuses, right? Remain with the anachnu chatanu. So in order to prepare for Rosh Hashanah and for Yom Kippur and Aseret Yemei Teshuva, before you can actually do tshuva and start with stopping the sin and regretting it and accepting not to do it and saying vidui, which is the avot of Rosh Hashanah, Aseret Yemei Teshuva and Yom Kippur, first you have to have an elul, where you recognize that you did something wrong. And that's hinted to in another aspect of elul, lule hamanti diros betuv Hashem. The word lule, backwards, is elul. Says the Gemara in Brachas, what does that pasuk mean? And the word lule in nach, on klaf, there's dots on the letters lule. Chazal say whenever there's dots on a letter, you have to read the sentence with that word and as if it's erased. Both are meaningful. So the Gemara says in Brachas, David HaMelech said, Hemanti liros b'tuv Hashem. I know for sure there's an Olam Haba. But lule hemanti, I'm not sure if I'm going to be zochet to be part of that. So you have to be sure and know exactly what's right and what's wrong. At the same time, to have doubts, maybe I'm not going to be part of that because I don't really know what's right and what's wrong. And I'm not sure if I color the aveiras into mitzvahs and justify them away. So Elul is a time to be makir and to hakoras hachet, to recognize the sin. So that are the three aspects of Elul. Ending the year properly, preparing to begin a new year properly, and beginning the process of 40 days where you transform yourself into a new person on Yom Kippur. And after you finish all of that, then we'll be zoche to Zman Simchaseinu. And the Iker Simcha should be that this year, Tavshin Pei Gimel, which is Motzoi Shvius, and Chazal say that Mashiach, the potential for Mashiach, every Motzoi Shvius is stronger. And it should be this Motzoi Shvius, when we see the real Zman Simchaseinu that follows that 40-day process that culminates in Yom Kippur, and then we celebrate Zman Simchaseinu. The Simcha should be Simcha V'Yartzecha, V'Sasam V'Yivecha, וצמיחס קרן בדוגן עבדך, ועריחס נר לבן אישה נשיחך, ותלו בין.
אמן. It's 16.